ahead and get started.
Good morning, budding logicians. You can think of yourself as a budding logician. Budding means you're just beginning to your stage in your life where you get into full bloom. And a logician is somebody who understands and uses logic very well. And that's what we want you to be able to do. Understand and use logic very well. Because logic are the principles of correct reasoning. And correct reasoning is useful in every area of life. And I like how he's going to put out in the next chapter, chapter 3, that when you reason correctly, then you're reasoning in a way that is similar to God. And so it's actually godly to use good logic. And I thought that's a great point that he brought out in his book. Now, we're going to start off this morning with a word of prayer, because that's always good to do. Then we're going to take attendance, and we're going to do a quick review, and then we're going to grade the homework here in class and discuss it together, and then we're going to learn a few new things, and then have a little bit of small group time at the end. All right, that's the plan for this morning, so let's start off with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for bringing us together to be able to learn and grow and study. Thank you for giving us minds that are capable of thinking in a way that is like yours. Lord, we thank you for creating us rationally, creating us logically. And we thank you for teaching us how to spot bad thinking and incorrect reasoning so that we can be a blessing and make right decisions and see things correctly for ourselves, for our family, for our community. Lord, we pray this morning we would all have open hearts that are able to be taught and eagerness to learn, and give me the right words to teach in the right spirit with an attitude of love towards you and love towards these students of mine. Thank you for all of these blessings and for answering our prayers, and we know that you are here with us. Amen. All right, so first thing I want to do is take attendance, like I said, and we will streamline this at some point where I get one of the parents to take attendance as you come in, but it's still good for me to do it, so I'm learning names as I do it. And it's also good for you because you've probably got some names that you'd like to learn. So when I call your name, raise your hand and say here, and if you want to learn names with me, you can look around. All right, so I think the Benish family is gone. Trace and Trevor are not here. They let me know they were going to be gone. Hunter Detweiler?
Here.
Hunter, gotcha. Jackson Detweiler?
Here.
I thought you might be next to your brother. Carolyn Hips?
Here.
There's Carolyn. And I saw Melanie Hips sitting next to her sister. Nice to see siblings that don't hate each other. Brinley Kaiser? Is Brinley here? Evelyn Locker is always going to be online. She lives quite a ways away. Grant Lenzen? Grant is here. Lucy Lenzen?
Here.
Lucy. Nicholas Lenzen? The Mrazes are gone. Daria, Joseph. Let's see, Hayden Nichols?
Here.
Hi, Hayden. Haley Nichols?
Here.
All right. Hey, more sisters together. My family's the only one that doesn't sit together. Blake Renke? Blake's not here. Katrina Shamber?
Here.
Katrina. Elise Schmidt is here. Where's Clarissa?
Here.
Oh, you're invisible this morning. Aiden. Raise your hand, Aiden. Ian Taylor?
Here.
Ian. Your brother Isaac. And Petra is not here. All right.
You did great. Miss Wagner's, by the way.
Yeah, again?
Naomi and Robin.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I just printed this off and forgot to add what I added last week. So we've got Naomi and Romar are here. Okay. Did I get everybody? All right, thank you. So last week we began to introduce the book on introducing logic. That's a lot of introducing. And one of the things that we started off with was this quote from Thomas Traherne. And review is important because repetition is the key to learning. Now, seems like when I was in school, the teachers weren't quite so, what's the word I'm looking for? they weren't such babysitters, sorry, don't mean to insult you, that they would review everything like this all the time, especially as I got older. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe I'm thinking of as I was in college and seminary and stuff. They didn't always, you know, review the lessons for us. They expected to be able to say it once and for you to take notes and for you to learn it. And that's what students did. Students took notes and learned what the instructor taught them. And the instructor wasn't always holding their hand and saying, "No, come along, let's review this so that you get it in your little mind." So Thomas Traherne has this great quote: "As nothing is more easy than to think, so nothing is more difficult than to think well." And I love that quote because, well, why don't you explain to me why I love that quote? What do you think is so wonderful to me, maybe to you also, about this quote? Yeah?
It's true, and it's simple and straight to the point.
Yes, and it's something we need to hear. You know, it's true, it's straightforward, and it's something we need to hear, that we get into bad habits of thinking, and we reason poorly because, as Hamlet said, "My wit's diseased." Your wit is your mind, your reasoning, and our mind, our wits, are diseased with sin. And sin causes us to think badly. We reason badly. So often, it's not just an honest mistake of, I meant well, but I just made a mistake in my logic somewhere. But no, that the problems in our thinking are really ethical problems at their root. That our heart likes to justify ourselves. And in order to justify ourselves and protect our ego and our pride, our mind is able to come up with all kinds of reasons for why we are justified in what we said and what we did. And that is really where a lot of the bad habits of thinking come from, is that pride that protects itself with bad reasoning. So learning how to spot bad reasoning is actually very helpful for you if you want to be a person who overcomes your pride and doesn't live in your sin. So we see that this study of logic, while often considered like a secular field of study, there is no such thing as a secular field of study. All knowledge comes from God. All knowledge is useful. It's all part of God's wisdom that He wants us to grab a hold of and understand and use correctly so that we live right. So everything belongs to God, including logic. Now, we want you to be able to think well. That's the goal of this class. Very important. Now, the other slide we had up here is that mathematics is like logic. Except mathematics uses numbers and logic uses ideas. We got another Wagner coming in. Remind me your name.
Ariana,
that's right. Great. So in math, you've got numbers and symbols, and you do calculations, and it can be right, it can be wrong. That's the way it is with logic as well. You've got symbols, and instead of numbers, you use letters. And the letters represent what? Anybody know what the letters represent? It starts with a P. That's why we often use P's when we're talking about logical letters.
Propositions.
Good. A proposition is a statement of fact, a statement of truth. And the proposition can either be correct or incorrect. It can be true or false. And so when you've got statements that can be true or false, then you link them together. And if you start off with a true statement, and then you use correct deduction and logic, reasoning, then you can add to your knowledge. You can come up with new statements of truth based upon the statements of truth that you have. And what this really shows, this is important, is that truth builds upon itself. And error also builds upon itself. That if you start with a false statement, and then you make deductions, you use your reasoning, you use your logic to come up with additional statements of truth, those additional statements of truth, while they might logically follow from your beliefs, if your beliefs are wrong, then your conclusions also could be wrong. That your proof is invalid because your initial statements were not true. And so this is why it's so important to have foundational truth in your life. The author, Jason Lyle, he talks, I can't remember which chapter it was in, because I read lots of chapters yesterday. He talks about how the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and how all knowledge belongs to God. I think it's in chapter 3. Might be chapter 2. And Jason and I explained that pretty well, but let me attempt to explain it as well in a little different way. That when you start with the fear of the Lord, then your deductions based upon the fear of the Lord are, if you use good logic, good deduction, then they're also going to follow and be true. But if you start with the idea that there is no God, and then you make logical deductions based upon that idea, well then, even though your logic is sound, you may end up with some really false ideas. And this is what ministries like Answers in Genesis understand, that if you start as a scientist with this belief that there is no God and everything happens by natural processes, and therefore the beginning of life and the beginning of creation had come about from natural processes, and then you reason based upon that premise, well then your reasoning, is as good as your reasoning might be, is faulty because you started with a bad premise. And this is called examining presuppositions. You have to make sure that your presuppositions and your logic are true. Otherwise, your logical deductions based upon those presuppositions could well be false. So that's why I want you to see that math and logic are similar because they both deal with what is true and what is false. And you can do bad math, you can do bad logic, and it's important that we get these things right. I'd say logic is even more important than math. Now, you know, lives can depend upon good math. Do you ever see the video of the bridge that was constructed badly, and then when the wind was blowing, the bridge had way too much sway in it, and the bridge started to sway like crazy and then fell apart and fell to the ground. Some bad math there in trying to figure out how much sway do we build into the bridge at each point and the cumulative effect of that in destroying the bridge. So, you know, bad math can be pretty bad. But bad logic can be even worse because you can lead people to eternal destruction. You can lead people to a spiritual death through bad reasoning, through bad thinking. So it's very important that we get math right, probably even more important that we get logic right. And that's why it's such an important class in your education. And your parents realize that and want you to get a logic class at some point in your junior high and high school career. Now, with that review in mind, let's also talk briefly about the different branches of logic. And as you remember on your cover, we're going to be studying informal logical fallacies. So the diagram up here of P is the proposition she eats fruit, Q is the proposition he eats salad. So P and Q is the combined proposition she eats fruit and he eats salad. So that is formal logic. That's taking forms, like a mathematical formula, and now you've got a logical formula. And formal logic can get quite involved and can be just as challenging as math. And that's why I had formal logic as part of my math class when I was in junior high. Now, the informal logic is not writing out formulas on the board, but instead it's the more practical use of logic when we are discussing things, when we're debating things, when you're having an argument. Have you ever had an argument, Detweilers?
Yeah.
You guys, you ever argue with brothers?
Yeah, we had one this morning.
Okay, yeah. And when you're having an argument, as we're gonna have in class, we're gonna have an argument later, you are presenting, this is true, therefore we should do this. And you're saying, okay, here's things that we know, and that's why we need to do this. And that's drawing an inference, and it's how you reason with people, how you argue for why we should do something. Later in class, we're going to be having an argument on whether or not we should take this book course load in one semester or two semesters. And so you'll have the opportunity to give arguments and to give reasons. We'll reason together as a group as to what's best for everybody. Should we do it in one semester or two semesters? So that is informal logic, where you're going to not be writing out the formulas of your reasoning on a whiteboard, but you're just going to be saying it and discussing it. That's the informal side of logic. And that's what Jason Lyle realizes most of us spend our time doing Most of us don't spend our time writing our logical proofs for our job or at home, but instead we just talk in logic in that informal manner. And so we need to be able to spot informal logical fallacies so that we aren't led into bad actions because of fallacious reasoning. Good? So that's informal logic. Formal logic and informal logic. And when you get into formal logic, there's subcategories of that as well. There's categorical logic, and there's propositional logic, and all kinds of different fields of study if you become a professional logician. And formal logic is the field that God calls you to write and study and publish and all of that. Now, let's get into then this last slide that I showed you last week. Maybe, there we go. And this one I use to show you how logic is useful for everything. This is better, quicker than this one. Put you aside. How logic is useful for everything. And so this is one way of categorizing the branches of philosophy. It's more of a classical way of doing it. If you're going back to the Greek philosophers, they would have put it in Greek rather than English. But they would have put something like this up on their chalkboard. I don't know if they used chalkboards back in ancient Greece. About the way that philosophy works. And it starts with what is the nature of reality? What is the ultimate reality? That's metaphysics. And then how do we know things? The science or the philosophy of knowledge is epistemology. That comes up in the worksheet that you guys did for chapter 2. And then ethics, the philosophy of what is right, what is wrong, how should we live an excellent, noble life. And then political philosophy, how do we all live together as a community. And then aesthetics is about art, and art is produced by culture, which is produced by communities that are living together. And so good art comes from a good philosophy, it all builds. So you wonder why Hollywood can't make good movies anymore? It's because they have bad ethics. And they have bad ethics because their theory of knowledge is all messed up. They don't know what ultimate reality is. And so when you've got people who are confused philosophically here, they end up making some pretty ugly art. It's funny how Hollywood's gotten so much better at using the tools of movie making, but they've gotten so much worse at actually making good movies as far as art goes, because you can be technically adept and you can have all the power tools but still build a really ugly house. And that's kind of what, and non-functional, not just ugly, but non-functional house. So they've got all these amazing tools and they're standing on the shoulders of giants in the movie making industry, but they're building really nonsensical, ugly houses. And this tells you why. And logic. This is the beautiful thing about logic. While it's technically a part of epistemology, and this is the science of knowledge, how do we know things? Well, we know things, one of the ways we know things is through the use of reasoning, correct reasoning, logic. But it's used in all of it. So even though it's epistemology is built on your metaphysics, you use logic to understand metaphysics. And so you see that it does have some circularity built into it, and you can't just purely study metaphysics without using epistemology and so on. So there's some overlap there. All right, well, with that review in mind, get out your homework from last week, and it's time to grade it. So I want you to exchange your homework with someone else and need a writing utensil. Now, when it comes to grading the homework, there's 10 questions on each assignment, and you can either be right, wrong, or half right, half wrong. Now I know that's terrible because we've been saying the propositions are either true or false, they're not half true or half false. Forgive me, there's going to be some questions where I end up giving half credit, but just remember, there's no proposition that is half true, but there are questions that you can give half right and half wrong in your propositional answer. Okay. Complicated, I know. And so you are going to grade them as we discuss it. And for a wait until I'm done explaining before I ask your question. For many of the questions, there's more than one way to answer the question. Now I've got an answer key here, And he kind of walked through what he thinks are the acceptable answers. But if you want to argue for your answer, and you can convince me through your reasoning, whether it's right or whether it's wrong, if you can fool me into accepting wrong reasoning, then I will give you credit for it. And so if you're not sure, you can ask and get some feedback from me on that. All right. So, number one. Somebody, let's see, let's just start here in the front. Would you read question number one for us, Naomi?
What is the definition of logic?
What is the definition of logic? Is that the whole question?
Mm-hmm.
I should have the questions in front of me. What am I doing? Here. Ta-da. All right. What is the definition of logic? Elise, what does your paper say?
The study of the principles of correct reasoning.
That is correct. Logic is the study of the principles of correct reasoning. If they just say the principles of correct reasoning, that's fine. If you say it's the study of the way God thinks, that is also okay because he did talk about that in the chapter. And so I think the best answer is the study of the principles of correct reasoning, but you still get full credit for a shortened version of the principles of correct reasoning, and you also get full credit for the study of the way that God thinks. Now, if they have something else and you're not sure whether it's right or wrong?
We need someone to trade with. Does anyone still have their own work?
But you can still trade, you know, if you trade with someone else, you can still trade again. You know, as long as you don't end up with your own. More than one trade is allowed.
Are you good?
Yeah. All right. Everybody good on number one? Good. Number two. Elise, read number two.
What does logic have to do with God?
And Ariana, what do you have for that on your page?
We use reasoning to discover truth, and God is truth. We use logic to learn about God and his world.
Okay, that's good. I like that. Any similar or different answers that you want to ask about? What does logic have to do with God? Yes, Amy.
This one has God is the standard for all truth claims.
Yep, that's exactly right. God is the standard by which all reasoning should be judged to be correct or incorrect because his mind determines the truth. You could also say something like, to study logic is to study how God thinks. So any of those types of answers, when you're relating logic to God's thinking, then that is what we're looking for here, driving that point home. It's kind of the main point of the opening chapter, wasn't it? All right, number three, second row. Somebody read number three for me. Go ahead, run and read number three. Is atheism a religious belief? Okay, so you can't just say yes or no because it says why or why not. So first you have to say, what's the answer, yes or no?
Yes.
Atheism is a religious belief. Now, when you talk to an atheist, they're going to insist that that is not the case. And so you can make your point. You can say, well, I believe that atheism is a religious belief because of this logical reason. And you can make your case, and they won't accept it, and they'll say, no, your reasoning is faulty, here's where my reasoning is right. And you can argue over that all day, but that's not really what we want to argue with atheists all day. But it's good for you to know that atheism is a religious belief. And why is atheism a religious belief? Caroline?
Because they base their entire life and worldview on believing that there isn't a God.
Right, yeah. So religions do what? Well, they talk about God. And so when you're talking about God not existing, you're still talking about God. And then religions also, then on the basis of their beliefs about God, determine how are we supposed to live, what's right, what's wrong, you know, all those things. And so atheism, based upon their belief that there is no God, talks about how are we supposed to live, what's better, are we making progress in our society, things like that. So it is functionally a religion, and so therefore we view it as a religious belief. Now, if you just want to settle with the atheist and say, well, I think it functions like a religion, so let's just leave it at that, that can be a good place to form a compromise of saying, I think it functions like a religion, And then you can go out and make your argument based upon that, that they won't necessarily have as good a time arguing against, that it functions in a similar way that religions function. And of course, you know, they can come up with all kinds of arguments against that too, but that aside for now. Anybody have any questions about number three as to whether or not the answer on your paper is correct? All right. Number four. What is a question that can be answered logically, but not scientifically? All right, somebody give me an example. Clarissa, what's on your paper?
What did Abraham Lincoln think about God?
What did Abraham Lincoln think about God? So this is something that can be answered logically, but not scientifically. He says on here, most historical questions would fit into this category. So I'd say that's a historical question. Good.
All right, so on my paper, he doesn't really give an example of one.
Uh-huh.
It more describes what it is.
Yeah.
The moral question tells whether something is right from wrong, and can be answered logically, but not scientifically.
Okay, so it's telling you what kind of a question. It's not giving a specific example in that category.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I'll accept that.
I have a question.
Yes.
Some of the questions that can be answered logically by like a Christian, we would consider it as objective.
Uh-huh.
Other people would see as subjective. So how do we
we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Great question. That's one of the things on my list of things to talk about today is objective and subjective.
Okay.
So if they have a moral question, like is it wrong to steal? If they have a mathematical truth, that is also different from science. Math is more like logic and not really science. Now the physicist, who is a scientist, uses math all the time. Physics is basically applied math, if you've taken a physics course. And so you can see how people would get confused and think, no, math is science. Science is math. But they're using the word science differently than in its strict definition. Okay? What is the strict definition of science? Anybody know?
Gaining knowledge by hypothesis and observation.
Yeah, and experimentation.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So through observation and experimentation, you gain knowledge of what?
The current world.
The physical world. Okay. Physical world. Science deals with physical things. Through observation of physical things, through experimentation on physical things, that's science. Now, some people will use a much broader definition of science and say just anything that we can know is science, because the word science means knowledge. And so they will get confused on what science is and use this broader definition because they are philosophical naturalists. What is a philosophical naturalist? Naomi?
Someone who believes that the physical world is the only thing there is.
Yes. That if he believes the physical world is all there is, well then observation of the physical world and experimentation on the physical world is the primary, or you could say the only way to gain knowledge. So you can see how they would confuse mathematics, because everybody knows that math is a good way of knowing things, with science because of their philosophical naturalism, and they think, well, the physical world is all there is. But are numbers a part of the physical world? The numbers represent quantities that exist in the physical world, but the representation, the symbol of a quantity, the idea, is not a physical thing. And this is where philosophical naturalism gets all screwed up. And people who believe that the physical world is all there is, they make all kinds of bad reasoning. They come up with bad definitions, they come up with bad arguments, because they can't distinguish between what is physical and what is non-physical. And that is kind of important. The difference between math and science has to do with that distinction. You see how they confuse that because of their philosophical naturalism. All right? So I like how Jason Lau brought up that there's questions that can be answered logically but not scientifically. He also had a great example of a proof that is mathematic that you can't do in science. What was the mathematical proof that he gave that was not a part of observation and experimentation? You can't do the observation. You can't do the experiment. What was that? Remember? Yeah.
If you add two numbers and you keep
look at the top of page 6. Everybody get your book out. Look at the top of page 6. See, he's got the 1 plus 1 half plus 1 fourth plus 1 eighth plus 1 16th plus 1 32 equals, and go on for infinity. You end up with 2. So there's this infinite number of additions that you do where you keep on having the fraction from 1 to 1 half to 1 fourth to 1 eighth. You add up 1 half and all of its fractions for infinity, and you end up with 2. Now, you can't actually run that experiment. You can't just start off with your pencil and paper and start adding them all up and then end up with 2, because it's an infinite series. You can't do an infinite experiment because you don't live forever and you don't have infinite amount of time to do it in. So here's an example of a mathematical truth that cannot be exhibited through observation and experimentation. I thought that was pretty cool. All right. All right, backside of the homework. Number 5. Can God say something false? Why or why not? All right, can God say something false? Everybody says?
No.
No. God cannot say something false. Now, why can God not say something false? What do you got on your page? Somebody that haven't called on yet? Nicholas, what do you got on your page?
Because God determines truth.
God determines truth. Good. Yes, that was a point that was made well by Jason Lyle in the chapter. Anybody have a different answer? Yep.
Half of my answer says it would contradict his character. Does that count?
He has on here, one of the possible answers is it is contrary to God's self-consistent nature. It's basically what your paper says. All right, any other answers that you have a question about? All right, then let's go on to number 6. Can God learn anything new? Everybody says?
No.
God cannot learn anything new. And why can God not learn anything new? Come on, I'm taking up my precious time here. Jump in. Yes, that's right. You can't learn anything when you know everything. And some people are troubled by that. They think, well, it's so fun. It's so exciting to learn things. And God is missing out on the excitement of learning. And if that is your understanding of the blessedness of God, you're reasoning like a child. You don't realize the joy of knowing as opposed to the joy of learning. The joy of learning is great. The joy of knowing is wonderful. So God cannot learn anything because he already knows everything. There's no knowledge beyond God's mind, and God's mind is the source of all truth. Any answer that involves one of those statements is great. Number 7. How is our thinking like God's thinking? Aiden, what does your paper say?
We can think like God because we can think in a way that is consistent with his character.
Okay. Good. And other answers. How's our thinking like God's thinking? There's got to be some different ones. What else you got? Yep.
We both think logically.
Good. Yep. Exactly. What else? Any other answers out there? Yep.
Because we were made in his image, so we share some similarities with him.
We're made in his image, so we share similarities with him. That is why our thinking is like God's thinking, but it's not how our thinking is like God's thinking. I'm going to give half credit for that one. Half credit.
Which one would we write?
What do we write? I don't understand your question.
Are we noting anything on the page?
Yes, you're noticing incorrect answers.
Right, but do you want us to write like 1/2 next to the question?
Yeah, minus 1/2 is what you put next to it if it's half wrong. Yes. Now, number 8. How is our thinking unlike God's thinking? Romar, what does your paper say?
We can reason incorrectly.
We can reason incorrectly. God cannot reason incorrectly, right? Another way to say that is we can be mistaken. Or you can go back to some of the previous questions, like we can be illogical. We can learn new things. We can believe something that is false. We can't think of all the infinite possibilities. We can't know everything. So those are some of the ways that our thinking is unlike God's thinking. Good to think about it. How God thinks, how we think, how they're similar, how they're different. Hope this is opening up some meditation and some interest in that subject in your mind. That curiosity, the desire to learn, the desire to ask questions, the desire to think it over and come to an understanding, to use your reasoning, to not just receive the input of Jason Lyle's reasoning, but then to think about what he is telling you and come with your own deductions, your own arguments, your own exploration of the ideas, bringing in a new proposition and combining it with the proposition that you just read in the book and saying, well, if that's true, and if this is true, then this also is true. And so I encourage you to engage in that type of meditation. Meditation is thinking over a matter, chewing it over, and spending time doing that. So don't allow your phones and your iPads and all the screens in your life to just be giving you input all the time. Put them away. Turn them off. Spend some time thinking. Develop that habit and that practice of thinking. One of the greatest preachers in American history would go on long horse rides. And on his horse rides, he would just think. And when he had a thought that was particularly helpful or useful, he would actually jot it down while he's riding his horse. And then he would pin it to his jacket. And on a long ride, and he'd come home and he'd have his jacket just full of notes of things that he'd been thinking about on his ride. And so that's a practice of reasoning, logical, thoughtful people. And I want to encourage that among you all. Okay. Now, number 9. Which blank gets the word discover and which blank gets the word determine? Let's all say it together. Our mind
discovers
truth. God's mind determines truth. Okay? So that's all right or all wrong. There's no half credits here. Discover is our mind. Determine is God's mind. And I encourage you to spend some time thinking about it. That's really fascinating. God's mind doesn't discover truth like you do. But God's mind determines truth. That when God thinks, then that is what he creates. And that is what is a part of our physical universe and our physical reality. I wonder, you know, take truths like mathematical truths of 2 plus 2 equals 4 or 8 squared is 64 and think about, is that something that is only true in our universe as something like arbitrary that God came up with? Did God just create mathematics somewhat arbitrarily in order to create a physical universe that operates on those mathematical principles? Or are those truths of 2 plus 2 equals 4 and 8 squared is 64, are those eternal truths in the mind of God, and that's the only way that he could create any universe? Ask questions and think about questions. That's part of the joy of being a rational creature. I want you to use the brain that God has given you. All right, then the last one, number 10. Can God be illogical? And everybody says,
No.
God cannot be illogical. Why or why not? Somebody tell me why God cannot be illogical. Melanie, what's your paper say?
Well, it's incursive.
Oh, yeah, go.
God can't be illogical because his whole being is logical.
Good, yeah. By his nature, God always reasons correctly. To be illogical is to think differently from God. God can't think differently from himself. God is always reasoning correctly. So there's lots of ways to answer this. Anybody have a question about whether or not the answer on your paper is right or wrong? All right, so right at the top of your page, how many were correct out of 10? 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10. Then you give it back to the person who owns it. Make sure that the name of the person who owns it is in the top left corner. There's no name on it. That's going to make it tricky for me. So make sure your name is on your paper. And then hand them in to the middle. And Romar, why don't you pick them all up as they get handed towards the middle and bring them up here. All right. Well, this is great. This is good discussion. This is good review. It's taking a little bit more time than I anticipated. So this might be a factor in our discussion later as to how quickly we're going to go through this class material. So let's have that discussion while we've got time here. All right? Last week, I mentioned that we could go through the lessons in this book. How many lessons are in this book? Table of contents says there are 38 lessons in this book. We could go through the 38 lessons in this book in one semester. If we did two or three a week, we could go through the 38 lessons in this book in two semesters if we did one or two a week. And so I left it up to you to go home and think about and discuss with your parents whether or not we should do this in one semester or two. So, what are some of your arguments for one or two? And then after we've listened to the arguments, we're going to vote on it as a class. So listen to the arguments. And don't just vote what you think is best for yourself. That's how democracies fail. When everybody votes for what they think is best for themselves, we're setting ourselves up for tragedy. But when you vote for what is best for others, as a Christian would vote, then that's how democracies succeed. And so let's be a Christian democracy here this morning and vote for what is best for others. So listen carefully to the arguments that your neighbors give as to why they think it is best to do it in one semester or two. Who wants to start off with an argument one way or the other? Yes, Aiden.
So do I just stand here?
Yep.
All right. Well, I definitely think that this should be done in two semesters. Now, I know that I'm not the only person here who has got a lot of homework, but that'd be kind of selfish because my homework, I'm worried about it. But what I'm really worried about is learning as much as I can over the course of this class. As this class is longer, I'll have more time to absorb the information, think more logically, and I want that for myself and for all of us. So I definitely think this should be a two-semester class.
Okay, thanks, Aiden. So Aiden says that because of the amount of other homework that he has, and he assumes that that is the case for a lot of you as well, that it would be kind of overwhelming to try to fit in all of this along with all of your other homework in one semester. Does anybody want to agree or disagree with that proposition? Yes.
Yeah, but if we do it in one semester, this means you have more time. We all have more time next semester to get the rest of our homework done and spend more time on that when we have tests coming up.
Good. So, an argument for two semesters is that then that opens up a lot more time in the second semester. And so, we have to figure out what is the wisest use of our time to get things done now or to have less time later. No. Yeah. Something like that. You guys know what I'm saying. You know the thing. So, other arguments. You guys talked it over. What is an argument in favor of your preference? Yep.
Okay, so obviously the chapters are short. I don't think doing three chapters over two chapters is going to be that much of a difference. And so if you're doing the homework already and you're already working on it, just do another chapter and it'll open up so much more time next semester for you to do other things. That's my personal opinion, but I think it'd be worth it.
Yeah, so it can be wise to put more work in now, knowing that that's going to give you more freedom later. We always have a tendency to want to procrastinate and say, well, I don't want to have too much to do right now. But then when we come later in our life, we look back and say, well, I wish I'd gotten all that done earlier so that now I had time for this, this, and this other thing. So very important to weigh that out. Yes?
I would like the opportunity to, if there is another logic course offered, I'd like to have the opportunity to absorb more information, because I think a week is enough to get all that done and absorb the information.
Yeah. So one of the benefits of doing it all in one semester is that we could offer another course in the second semester where you could learn more and go deeper. And that's exciting to me. I like that idea, so thanks for bringing that up. Other considerations, other arguments.
I think we should do one semester because I know that several of us are athletes in here and play basketball, and in the second semester, for me and for others, basketball picks up and gets a lot busier. So then I have the time now to do the class.
Good, good. So we had a number of basketball players here. Basketball players, raise your hands. Yeah, it's a pretty good size of the class. So important to take into consideration their needs. Thanks. All right, any other arguments that you want to get in here before we vote? I would like to add the argument of what I just discovered, that it takes a significant amount of class time to go over the homework in class. And if we do two or three a week, I don't know how I would be able to go over two or three of these lessons in a week and sufficiently discuss that. So that might be a challenge, and that's a consideration. It's starting to make me lean in a direction that I hadn't thought of before I did the class here today. So that's a new consideration for me. Anything else?
This doesn't have to do with it, but we did do two chapters this week.
Yes, you did do two chapters this week. But we've only graded one in class so far. Let's get a feeling for the room. What did you think? Was two chapters more homework than you want, about right, or less? Raise your hand if it was more than you wanted it to be, more than you liked. Raise your hand if it's about right. Raise your hand if it's not enough. You gotta have more. All right. So that gives us a good idea. So look around, see how the feeling of the group is on that. Take other people's feelings into consideration. That's why we do things like that. All right? Well, let's go ahead and take a vote then. And I will have Aiden pass out the ballots. On your ballot, you will write one or two for one semester or two semesters. Very simple. Write one or two on your ballot. Make sure everyone gets one ballot, Aiden. No mail-in ballots. No voting early and often. It is reported that Joseph Stalin once said, it's not so much important who votes, but who counts the votes. So, we will need some honest and reliable folk to count the votes for us. Let's appoint a man and a woman so we keep it gender neutral. The Detweilers are nominating each other. That looks suspicious. Let's have Caroline count. And let's have Romar. All right, Caroline and Romar, pick up the ballots and count them, please. Bring one to share. Alright, you can sit here and count them. The rest of you, let's get to worksheet number two going on here. A late ballot coming in. Alright, get out worksheet number two. We're going to try to get through worksheet number two here in the 10 minutes that we got left. All right. So we're going to do this in one. one semester, that means two or three homework assignments a week. We'll do another two this coming week. I've got the handouts for lessons 3 and 4, so we'll hand those out here at the end. But for now, let's work through lesson number 2. Pull up my answers again. All right, chapter 2 worksheet. The first question is, where does knowledge ultimately come from and how do you know? All knowledge ultimately comes from?
God.
God, that is correct. And who wants to read off of their paper and tell me how do you know? Let's go quick.
The Bible.
Yep.
I have that on my paper, but I consider that circular reasoning.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about circular reasoning. Good. I thought there might have been a little bit of circular reasoning in this chapter as well, so let me make note of that, and we'll come back to that thought. Circular reasoning in chapter 2.
So would you be
Jason Lyle often gets accused of circular reasoning, and he's very good at explaining why it's not circular reasoning. Yes?
If just the second part of the question is not answered, is that just one half off?
Yes. If they get half the question right, they get half credit.
Would that the Bible question still get full credit, though?
Let's see here. Let me look at his answer. Yep.
Okay.
We know this because God himself has told us in his word, the Bible. Which, of course, begs the question, how do we know that the Bible is God's word? And that is a subject for a different class. Yes?
Wait, but that wouldn't be circular reasoning because the Bible can be proven by outside.
Exactly. Yes. You're on the right track. Good thing.
I'm not arguing that it's not God's word, but that he's arguing for himself. Like, he's arguing for himself. You wouldn't ask someone who was making the claim why you're making, are you true? And they would obviously say that they are true.
We're not going to get into that right now because we got to get through the worksheet, but this is a great discussion, and it's exactly what I want to encourage, so I'm sorry I have to delay it right now. All right, number 2, what is revelation? Somebody read off their answer. What is revelation?
God teaching us,
yes, that's good. It's God giving knowledge, which is also God teaching. And revelation is mostly used in God giving knowledge, although people who don't believe in God will sometimes talk about revelation as if it's some kind of spiritual experience. It's not from God, you know, from the universe or something like that. All right, so then number 3, what is special revelation? Nobody has an answer on their paper?
The disclosure of information from God to man contained in the Bible.
Good, yes. Special revelation is the disclosure from God to man contained in the Bible, God's word. It is special because it is given to certain people in certain times. Did the first brothers, Cain and Abel, have the book of Revelation? No, they didn't. The book of Revelation wasn't given to man until 90-95 AD, and so anybody born before that didn't have it, and even now there's many people in the world who don't have the book of Revelation in their language, and so it's special because it's not given to everyone at all times and all places, whereas general revelation is that knowledge of God that is given to people in all times and in all places. So there's general revelation and special revelation. General, everyone. Special, not everyone. Yes?
Okay, so I just put down the Bible. Would that be half credit or wrong?
Special revelation, Bible. Sure, I'll take it. Okay. All good in the hood. Number 4, what does objective mean? What is objective? Yep.
The same for everyone?
Yep, good. Same for all people. It means outside of the person, outside of the subject. It has to do with the object, what is true in itself, in the object, not in relationship to some subject. For example, objective, this pencil is made of wood. Subjective, this is my pencil. The relationship to me is subjective. Objective is the object in itself. This pencil contains lead. Objective, it's the object. The truth about the object. The truth of the subject. I like this pencil. It's relationship to me. Okay. So, subjective is relational. Objective is truth in itself. The truth in the object. And that's something that is very confusing for a lot of people because we use the word subjectivity and objectivity and subjectivism and all of that, and it gets very confusing. But I want you to understand the basic idea of objective means in the thing itself, whereas subjective means in relationship to the subject that is being talked about. Okay? Both are important. Number five, what does propositional mean? Let's keep it rolling. What's propositional mean? All you quiet folks.
A truth claim that is either true or false.
Yes. Propositional means it's in human languages that are true, in sentences that are true or false. It technically means it's made up of propositions, but a proposition is, like you said, a statement that is either true or false. Propositional knowledge is clear because it's communicated in words that have specific meaning. Right. Number six, what are some ways in which human beings acquire knowledge? Different ways. Again, some, you have to have more than one. Got to be at least two or three on your page. Yeah.
School, books, and the internet?
No. That's not what we're looking for.
Special revelations of the revelations.
Okay. Good. Yeah. That's one. One and a half, maybe. Yeah.
Reason and logic.
Good. That's one. Logic, reason, two ways of saying basically the same thing.
I had rational deduction.
That's another way of talking about a logic. Good.
Through our senses, our deduction, or just being born.
Okay, so there's innate knowledge that we're born with. Like there's a sense of right and wrong that is just there from the time that we are babies. And then there's observation, things you see and hear, that's knowledge that you're gaining. And then there's communication, knowledge that is communicated to you. You trust the person who is telling you. I was at Hy-Vee last week and I saw George Bush. And so if you believe me, then that's knowledge about where I and George Bush were last week that you're gaining from faith in what I've told you. So believing what people tell you, seeing things with your own eyes, innate knowledge that God gives you, those are all different ways of knowing things. Math, science, logic, all of those are good answers. So they need to have at least a couple of those in there. Yeah?
The Bible and also trying things.
The Bible and what?
Also trying things.
Trying things? Well, that's a way of saying science, you know, experimentation. So yeah, special revelation and experimentation, all except those. As long as they got two of those types of things in there. If they only have one, give half credit. Okay. And then, that's not, where'd my paper go? Did I lose it? Oh, no. It's just the questions are so much like the other ones that it's confusing. How is our mind like God's? Number seven, how is our mind like God's? What do you got on your paper? I have you trade, so you don't have to feel embarrassed about reading if you're reading someone else's. The ability to speak rationally. That is one way that our mind is like God's. Yes. Rational. What else?
We are able to reason and our minds can know things.
Good. Yeah. You could also have something like we can know right from wrong. Remember in the Genesis? The day that you eat from the tree, you will discern good and evil and be like God. So that's one way our mind functions like God's. We know the difference between right and wrong. God also does that. Any questions about the answer on your paper? Everybody good? All right, number eight. How is our mind unlike God's mind?
We don't see the whole picture.
Right? Yep. Our mind is finite. God's mind is infinite. He sees the whole picture. Aiden?
We are perfect and our knowledge is limited.
Good, yeah. That's all on the same lines. Other answers? Yeah.
God's mind determines truth while our mind discovers.
Excellent, good. I'm glad you brought that one in.
We see things differently and process them differently from God.
Yeah, Very true.
We choose the wrong path sometimes.
That would be the next one. No, that is this one, right? How is our mind unlike God's? Yeah. We can make mistakes and therefore choose the wrong path. Very good. Right, then number 9. If all knowledge is from God, if P, then Q. If all knowledge is from God, that's a proposition, all knowledge is from God, then, deduction, how are unbelievers able to know anything at all? Okay, so not a deduction, sorry. Recognize we're a question here, not a statement. So, the question is predicated on this. If the premise that all knowledge is from God is true, then explain how are unbelievers able to know anything at all? Does the statement that unbelievers are able to know things disprove that all knowledge is from God? Why or why not? What does your answer say?
God graciously gives them knowledge.
Good, yeah. That's what he said in the chapter. It doesn't prove that knowledge doesn't come from God. It proves that God is gracious, and he gives knowledge even to people who reject him and pretend he doesn't exist. All right? So if you have an answer like that, that's great. Any other answers that you have a question about? All right. Then that brings us to number 10. When non-Christians reason correctly, does this show that they do not need God to reason? Why or why not? If non-Christians reason correctly, does this show that non-Christians don't need God to reason? Yes or no?
No.
No, it doesn't. Why not? Yeah. So, if I give you $100, and then you go to the store, and you buy something, and you say, I bought this with my own money, I didn't need Timothy to do this at all, you'd be lying to yourself, because you needed me to give you the money, so you go to the store and buy it, but you didn't acknowledge that, you forgot that, and you just saw what you did, and you're like, I did this all by myself. And that's the way the unbeliever is. He gets all this reasoning, he gets all these gifts of knowledge from God, and he goes on and uses those gifts that God has given him, and he says, look, I don't need God. And he's not acknowledging, he's forgotten that everything he has is from God. So just because someone doesn't acknowledge or realize the dependence upon God doesn't mean that there's not a dependence upon God that is there. The way that my seminary professor in apologetics explained this, he says, non-Christians are like a child who is sitting on their father's lap and is slapping him in the face. They're dependent upon the father, they're sitting on his lap, but they're slapping him in the face as if they were independent of their father. And that sense of independence, while being completely dependent, is the foolishness of the childlike unbelief. Okay. All right. Well, that is a good stopping point for us, so let's talk about the assignment then for next week. I'm going to have more time for us to pair up and review the flashcards and engage in an argument and talk about objectivity and subjectivity. So I'm going to think through my class plan for next week and figure out how we can grade the papers and still get other things done in class as well. So you'll be reading next week chapters 3 and 4. And I've got the worksheets here for chapters 3 and 4. So take one of each and pass those around. And then also hand your papers in towards the center for chapter 2. And Romar, again, pick those up and bring them up here for me. We're getting it all worked out. All right, thank you. Any questions about the homework, the flashcards, the reading, the worksheets? Pretty straightforward. If you have any questions and you don't want to ask in class, you can email me. You can also talk with me after class. What time do we say we're going to be done, Jamie?
9:30.
I still got 5 minutes? Yay, I got 5 minutes. You guys stay with me another 5 minutes? All right, so one of the things I mentioned earlier that I wanted to talk about, and we just briefly touched on, was objectivity and subjectivity. So let's do this together, okay? Objectively, this pencil is made out of wood. Subjectively, this is my pencil. Let me give you another example. Objectively, Reese's peanut butter cups are made by the... What company? What company makes Reese's peanut butter cups?
Oh, sorry, it's not to answer the question, but does that mean that the question of
We're getting to that.
Okay.
You're jumping ahead. We're just going to build the baseline, and then we'll get to the complications, all right? Now, objectively, Reese's peanut butter cups are made at a factory in Pennsylvania. Just go with me on that. Subjectively, Reese's peanut butter cups are my favorite candy. So you see what it means to talk about something objectively versus what it means to talk about something subjectively. Subjective is a subject. I'm a subject. You're a subject. And so you can talk about things in relationship to a subject. All right, another example. Objectively, 2 plus 2 equals 4. Subjectively, how do you feel about 2 plus 2 equaling 4? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Does it make you feel warm and fuzzy? Do you have no emotional response to 2 plus 2 equals 4? What is your subjective response to the fact that 2 plus 2 equals 4? All right, so you're starting to get the idea of what is objective and what is subjective. Objectively, Clarissa is a human being. Subjectively, Clarissa is my daughter. Her relationship to me, subjective, is she's my daughter. Now, you might think, well, that is objective truth. Objective truth is that Clarissa is my daughter. Because you're saying something that is true, everybody recognizes. Everybody recognizes Clarissa is my daughter. It's objectively true. But no, it's a relationship that exists between us. Whether you're thinking of Clarissa in herself or whether you're thinking of Clarissa in her relationship. Now, actually, that might be a bad example. And that's why we do this stuff with thought exercise. Maybe it is objectively true that Clarissa is my daughter, because while it is a relationship, it is something that is also objectively true in her person. Her DNA is half my DNA, and that's what makes her my daughter. So maybe if I said she's my favorite daughter, that would be, subjective. So thinking through what is object and what is subject, it can get kind of complicated, as you see, that what is relational and what is true in the object itself can be looked at in multiple ways and multiple levels. In one sense, Clarissa is my daughter is a relation. But in another sense, it's an objective truth about where she came from and how she came into the world. So it starts to get complicated, and that's what you're picking up on, Naomi. All right. Now, let's take a look at this question. Think through this with me. Is this objective or subjective truth? The most important thing to me is my family. Is that objective truth or is that subjective? The most important thing to me is my family.
Subjective.
Yeah, that's how we normally think of it, right? Most of you thinking subjective truth. But is that subjective truth because it's relating to me as a subject, myself relating to myself as a subject, to me, the most important thing is my family? Or could you say objectively to Timothy, or, Bob Bobson, the most important thing is his family. And if that is true about him in himself, and you're making that as a statement of fact, then it kind of sounds like an objective statement that Bob as an object has this, what's true about him, what he believes. Let's think about it this way, okay? I'm still thinking this through. Think it through with me. What if I said, it makes me sad that you believe this? Well, that would be my subjective response to what is his belief in himself. And so that is my subjective response. So subjects, they think, they feel, they believe. However, what is objectively the most important thing in life for everyone? Whether you realize it or not, whether you think it or not, what is the most important thing in life? Yeah?
Your opinion about God?
Yeah, your relationship with God. Your relationship with God is the most important thing. And if you're right with God, then you are going to be blessed beyond imagination. And if you're not right with God, you're going to have a terrible afterlife. And then you also live without meaning and purpose in your present life. And so you could say objectively, the most important thing for a person is a right relationship with God. It is a truth that is true for everyone, like he says in the chapter, and it's true whether you believe it or recognize it or not. So, objective truth often catches this idea of what is truth, whether you believe it or not. And so, whether I believe this pencil is made out of wood or not, it's made out of wood. It is, objectively, true. Now, if I believe that this pencil is my favorite pencil, could I be mistaken? Maybe it's not my favorite pencil. Maybe I forgot about another pencil that's actually my favorite pencil. I'm not thinking about it right now. I don't know, you might be my favorite pencil. Just think, just exploring the idea. I don't think that I've got it all figured out yet, but I want you to spend some time thinking about what is objective truth and what is subjective truth, and how do they relate, and are they important, and how do people talk about it, and could we talk about it and reason about it in a better way? All right, that's the only time I have right now. So, there's no one coming in. You can feel free to hang out here as long as you like today. Normally, we have to be out by 9:20. And I'm sorry I didn't tell you, you could have parked close today because we're the only ones using the building this morning. So you could have had all this nice parking spaces. But next week, we'll be back on our regular schedule where we'll have the other classes meeting here. We need to be out by 9:20 and need to continue to park away from the building so that the other co-op families can have the nice close parking places. All right. Well, thank you. Have a good morning.